Welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. This is your host, Andrew Vitelli, senior editor of Energy in the Americas for InfraLogic. Our guest today is Mike Mohammed, a director in Solomon Partners' infrastructure, power, and renewables practice focused on energy transition. Mike, thank you for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Mike, regular Crossroads listeners will be familiar with Solomon Partners and its energy transition practice, but for the rest of them, for new listeners, can you tell a little bit about the practice and where your focus is at the moment?
Absolutely. So our energy transition sector coverage sits within, as you noted, our broader infrastructure team, IPR, infrastructure, power, and renewables. Overall, I'd say that the infrastructure team itself is fairly complementary, and that includes beyond energy transition, conventional generation coverage, digital infrastructure, which is largely data centers today, as well as a transport and logistics strategy. For the energy transition team itself, which energy transition admittedly can mean a lot of things, post One Big Beautiful Bill, OBBB, in particular, we're focusing primarily on the infrastructure side of the energy transition. So that is really solar, wind, and storage coverage. This includes both utility scale as well as distributed generation coverage. And like many banks in the renewable space, the types of mandates that we will take on includes both platform deals as well as asset sales. I think one other thing worth mentioning is that Solomon is an affiliate of Natixis, the global financial services division of the BPCE group, which is the second largest banking group in France. Why I think that's relevant and worth mentioning is that the pairing of Solomon alongside Natixis enables us to bring balance sheet and broader lending services to our clients, which is highly complementary to the expert advisory services that we provide. Given how capital intensive the renewable space is, being able to provide both types of those services to our clients is highly unique and pretty powerful.
Absolutely. Thank you for that explanation, Mike. And you mentioned that the broader infrastructure group covers not only renewables, but also data centers and other infrastructure sources. Now, Mike, I always ask guests to talk about their background, and we've had a lot of different guests with a lot of different backgrounds on the podcast, but I think yours, particularly your path before you became an investment banker, is particularly unique. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And so, as you alluded to, I had a very unique first career. In undergrad, I had played college football at Cal Berkeley, and I was able to generate enough success for my time there that I was able to parlay that into getting drafted to the National Football League. I was a linebacker for 5 years, most notably with time spent with the Denver Broncos and Houston Texans. And while my goal was to run with that for as long as I could, I ultimately knew that is not a forever career. And so in the back of my mind, I knew that MBA school was something that I would pursue post-football, which I ended up doing at the University of Indiana. In the pivot to investment banking, I can't say that I started out knowing exactly that this is the path I wanted to go down, but as I reflected on some of my intangible skills, the perception was that being a great teammate, having strong communication skills, being coachable, particularly as a junior banker, resiliency, being a hard worker, those are all skills that I thought would apply to investment banking. Now, obviously, professional football and investment banking are completely different. But after doing it for over 8 years, I would say that theory about transferable skills certainly has held true. Once I determined that investment banking was the right path for me, I started to think about what industry I wanted to focus on. I really liked the high growth, long-term runway of opportunity that the clean energy industry was offering. I wanted to be in a space that was changing rapidly, that would offer me plenty of opportunity to rise through the banking ranks, if you will, and to ultimately carve out a segment for myself. And from there, as you noted, I now lead energy transition at Solomon.
That's quite an interesting story. And though I'd imagine in some ways it's maybe not as exciting as playing in the National Football League, I do think that the last few years in the clean energy space has been exhilarating in its own way. Am I right?
No, that's absolutely right. And again, wanted to be in an industry that was rapidly changing. And I think as we look where we're at here in 2026, the changes certainly are rapid.
You can certainly say that. Now, one thing we touched on is that energy in general and clean energy in particular is really focused the last couple of years around the increasing need for power driven in a large part, though not solely, by artificial intelligence and the data center build out. So as someone who's focused on the energy and the clean energy aspect of that, I'm curious how that affects your day-to-day. How are you participating in planning for that future?
Yeah, it's a great question. And as mentioned in some of the opening statements, there is quite a convergence right now between all things power, which is why I think our team is so complementary. Conventional generation, renewables, and digital infrastructure certainly all overlap and has made for a lot of very interesting discussions over the past, let's call it 18 months. It's really hard to say the magnitude of where this all shakes out in the long run and what the true opportunity is in terms of AI and data center build out, particularly given the pace of change with AI. And for example, do AI advancements one day unlock unknown power efficiencies that render current projections and the need for power obsolete? On the flip side, does requiring ever-increasing amounts of power to fuel ever-increasing complex models? I don't know if those are questions that we can necessarily answer today, but what we do know that under the current worldview, we need a lot of power. I thought it would be helpful to maybe share a quick few stats. Wood Mackenzie, for instance, is tracking roughly 250 gigawatts of disclosed data center pipeline at the end of 2025, which is roughly 25% of the entire U.S. peak load. Texas alone has 80 gigawatts of planned capacity. And again, this was as of the end of 2025. While I suspect that some of that is speculative, that is effectively doubling ERCOT's peak load. And so we're talking very big numbers here. I think ultimately power availability will be the limiting factor. And we are going to build out as much data centers as we have the supply for. But given some of the shortfalls in being able to bring new generation online quickly, as well as growing weariness for retail consumers to participate in quote unquote cost socialization of funding new generation simply for data centers, there is a lot of growing sentiment for bring your own generation today, BYOG. For these reasons, we're starting to see hyperscalers make direct investments into generation. And so in the renewable space, for instance, the two big ones that we just observed was Google's acquisition of Intersect Power, as well as Amazon buying the Pinegate Renewables Sunstone project in Oregon. But that being said, we're also seeing massive investments into the grid as well. So Meta recently announced a $27 billion partnership with Entergy, where Meta will fund new natural gas plants. They will fund transmission build out, new battery storage, ultimately to help firm up the grid for their data center investments in that region. And then something that's exciting too, and this is not contained to just traditional generation, but the need for power, we are starting to see massive investments and new partnerships being formed in next gen geothermal, as well as nuclear SMRs. And so going back to the theory and the discussion that the pace of change is very rapid, the renewable energy industry is certainly keeping us on our toes, and there's a lot to cover.
You talk about the need for power, and there is certainly tremendous appetite, as referenced by some of the deals that you talked about with some of these hyperscalers. I'm curious how you think renewables are suited to play that role. Can they play the main role in providing power for data centers for AI, or is more firm dispatchable power needed for a lot of these companies and their AI ambitions?
I think renewables certainly have a place. I think not every configuration will be able to be fully met by renewables alone. And that is why we are seeing the hyperscalers pay attention into all of the above. And again, it's next gen technologies like geothermal and nuclear, it's investments into the grid itself. But that being said, we are starting to see renewables players be able to, with renewables and batteries alone, start to meet the needs of simulating firm dispatchable power. And I think that is pretty powerful and really exciting for the sector.
Now, when it comes to the desire of a lot of these hyperscalers, a lot of them have plenty of capital. They're willing to spend a lot of money to meet their AI needs. The renewables sector is obviously ramped up considerably. What are some of the biggest challenges? What are some of the biggest bottlenecks in making this whole thing work from your perspective?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I would say there's several. So for example, with interconnection, pretty widely known fact that in most markets, if you start a project out today, you're looking at, on average, probably 5 to 6 years before that project is coming online. And while major queue reforms are happening to help advance projects quicker through the queues, and we are seeing queue numbers start to rationalize, they are still very overloaded. So that's one problem. Permitting is another. We are increasingly seeing restrictive local ordinances, as well as growing NIMBYism sentiment, if you will, that really cause restrictions on where we can actually build new generation. There's also no question that with the political administration right now, federal permitting has been a major challenge, and we have seen several shakeups happen in recent past, and the market is ultimately trying to work through. On the equipment side, gas turbine lead times average about 5 years if you were to put an order in today. I think as it pertains to renewables, equipment hasn't necessarily been an issue. In some respects, finding fiat compliant equipment for tax purposes is, particularly for storage. I think that's where most of the renewables equipment challenges present themselves. But in the broader equipment landscape, I think transformers continue to be a bottleneck and lead times can exceed multiple years. In summary, there are several factors that do limit how quickly we can bring this new generation online.
That's interesting. And I think the other side of the equation, you mentioned that the projections we have of power demand growth are contingent on a number of factors. For example, you mentioned the prospect that AI will allow such efficiency that we won't actually need all the power that we think we're going to need. And I guess another possibility is that while all of these hyperscalers, all these even maybe smaller firms are projecting great needs into the future, that perhaps, and I'm getting towards the edge of my expertise here, but they perhaps don't have the same type of path towards profitability that they expected. And one way or the other, the projections around AI needs, around data center needs, level out and don't have the type of exponential growth that's expected. is that a risk for the industry? And maybe this is less apt for renewables, which have shorter construction times than it is for, say, nuclear gas-fired. But I am curious for your perspective industry-wide.
Yeah, it again, I think it's hard to say exactly where we end up in terms of the projections and the actual power needs. Under the current worldview, it is very big. And I think part of how the market is addressing this is that, right or wrong, we are very focused on near-term projects, largely because of the ITC PTC sunset and the great benefit that provides. But at the end of the day, the sunsetting of the tax credits is not going to be the death of the industry by any means. In my opinion, losing the tax credits will force the industry to be more efficient, to trim the fat, so to speak, so that project economics can truly stand on their own without the backstop of tax credits. And so while the market is focused on the near term, to directly address your question, there is still a long-term investment thesis for renewables. We are still going to need massive amounts of projects and power in 2031 and beyond. But ultimately, there is an uncomfortable adjustment period that will be needed in the form of offtake and power prices are going to have to increase to otherwise provide developers with a similar level of returns. It's not going to be an immediate up and over to the right. And so that is why there is also such a strong emphasis right now from the market on near term, on projects that we can utilize the safe harbor to lock in the 4-year construction window to preserve those tax credits. And look, we're seeing in real time that not every developer has the capital to be able to utilize safe harbor. And they are, at the end of the day, going to be at a massive disadvantage in offtake pricing negotiations and ultimately the final project economics versus a larger, more well-capitalized player who has been able to safe harbor their pipeline. And I think we will start to see this materialize, and it's certainly going to be a case of the haves and have-nots, if you will.
Well, Mike, I do want to get back to what you're talking about on consolidation, because I think that's going to be a really interesting trend for the industry. But pivoting back to what you talked about when it comes to OB3 and some of the policy changes, it's been, at this point, I think right around 18 months since Trump was elected president and the industry knew it was going to have a less supportive political system in place. Last year around this time, we were talking about the contours of what would eventually be the one big beautiful bill. And I think by now, there's been a number of policy changes. There's been the rollback of credits, but I think the industry has a lot more predictability, stability, and understanding of what the climate looks like. So from where you sit, how has the industry adjusted to its new reality? And in that period, right, where some of the tax credits are just about to roll off, how has the adjusted to that?
Yeah, so as we turned the corner on 2026, post-OBBB, activity is really picking up. And this is on both the platform side as well as the asset sale side. For most of 2025, anything that touched development was really on the sidelines. If we don't know what type of tax credits we're going to have, we didn't know the magnitude. We knew they were going to change. We didn't know the magnitude or how quickly. Also, tariffs were really changing almost on a daily basis. And so if you don't know what your input costs are, how can you possibly price returns, price offtake? And so they put development for much of 2025 on hold. Development M&A, excuse me. Now, here we are in 2026. The capital needs of last year didn't go away. They were just postponed due to the uncertainty. And so similar to my previous comments, the market right now is really acutely focused on near-term projects. Anything that can come online before the ITC PTC sunset, we are starting to see a lot more platform activity as well. The last very robust M&A period for renewables was 2021 and 2022. And for a lot of financial sponsors out there, the typical hold period is 5 years. And we're coming up on year five here. And I think that activity is manifesting in what we're seeing in terms of the amount of deals out there in market right now.
I think this ties into what you were talking about before, where we're seeing some consolidation and a division between the haves and have-nots, where this might be an opportunity for some of the big players to take advantage of, where less capitalized, less established folks with less access to safe harbor, to tax credits, things like that, might find a little bit of difficulty without a larger sponsor. I'm curious whether how you see that playing out, and also whether there are risks to that, whether having too much consolidation could be not so great for the industry.
Yeah, it's a really good question. What I would say is development is really hard. It's getting harder. It's taking longer. With some of the interconnection reform that is ongoing that I was talking about, I didn't mention that development through that process is getting more expensive as well. And so what we are seeing is that achieving scale is ultimately going to be a strong driver towards determining who the winners and losers of development are going to be. And with just how capital intensive the industry is, many platforms are continuously forced to sell assets or repeatedly raise capital just to keep up with the capital needs. Yeah, absolutely. Essentially funding SG&A, development expenses, and project equity capital needs entirely through existing cash flow, that is the holy grail of renewables development and ultimately where the market is trying to get to. And so consolidation, in theory, is a great way to achieve that immediate scale, to diversify the business, to pick up additional capabilities or boost your presence in regions or technologies that you might be light in. But in reality, it's quite difficult, right? Who is the resulting management team that's going to run the combined business? Will there be cultural issues in the integration? Are there relative valuation differences? There's a whole slew of questions that you'd have to work through that all cause doubt and uncertainty to actually implementing consolidation. You asked about consolidation being a problem. I don't think we're close to that yet. The market is still very fragmented, and I just don't see the space being completely dominated by just a few large players anytime in the near term where that would potentially be an issue.
In recent years, we've seen domestic political challenges in the U.S., and now as we are recording this, we are also dealing with geopolitical uncertainty and potential geopolitical challenges. Now, things are fast moving. We are recording this on April 9th. It could be a different situation by the time listeners are listening. But as of now, there is in the conflict between the U.S. and Israel and Iran and some of its other neighbors, what I'd call a tenuous ceasefire in place. And the status of the Strait of Hormuz is, I think, somewhat uncertain both now and looking forward. Now, Mike, when I've talked to people in the renewable space, this in general doesn't seem like it's top of mind for them. If anything, they've said this just shows how you need domestic energy to not be exposed to these geopolitical uncertainties. If a solar or wind farm is producing electrons, they don't have to go through any straits. They don't have to go through any other countries. And I think that's true. At the same time, when you talk about construction, when you talk about development, we've seen how supply chain issues, things like that, around the COVID period have driven up costs in the past and made projects challenging, especially when it comes to projects that have their PPAs locked in and their costs exposed to outside events. I'm curious, Mike, do you think that the renewables industry is paying enough attention to this? Or do you think this is something, especially if we see gas prices elevated for a long time, that could drive up EPC costs and create another challenge, again, particularly for projects that have PPAs already?
Yeah, and what I have seen is that the industry essentially learned their lesson when inflation was running rampant in 21 and 22, where equipment costs really outpaced PPAs. And as you noted, having a PPA locked in already, a lot of projects fell underwater. And so with that still very fresh in mind, a significant portion of the market typically locks in PPA alongside EPC costs to avoid that similar sort of issue. I think another interesting point coming out of the war of Iran is generally there hasn't been much of an effect on the renewables market, at least to date. And if anything, I think this provides even more support behind the renewables build out, as there is increasing chatter, as you noted, about energy independence, which is ultimately a national security issue. And with solar and wind, the inputs are entirely homegrown, if you will. And at the end of the day, energy independence, it's a bipartisan issue. Now, there is some chatter out there that some of the members of the Republican Party are actually talking about introducing legislation to reinstate solar and wind incentives. Now, I don't see that getting much traction, but it is interesting to see that there is growing support and acknowledgement that renewables are important despite what was cut out in OBBB. I think another thing that's interesting is some of the permitting reform, for instance, the SPEED Act, which passed the House with bipartisan support, was ultimately designed to help alleviate permitting timelines so that we can move generation through much faster. When we look at PJM, just to use another data point, even the White House is weighing in on market reform and trying to be helpful in establishing bring your own power rules. So, long way of saying, I think that the war in Iran is ultimately renewing the focus that renewables are going to be important in the long run.
Absolutely. And I do think we're seeing a little bit of growing Republican support for solar in particular. I know Kellyanne Conway and Katie Miller have both come out in favor in some way of solar. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch. Mike, I think we're just about out of time. This has been a really interesting conversation, but I can't let you go without asking you one football question. We are recording this about 2 weeks out from the NFL draft. 15 years ago, you were drafted by the Denver Broncos. I'm a diehard Giants fan, so I have to ask, if you are the Giants sitting at number 5, who are you taking with that pick?
Yeah, this is a fun one. So, look, I think by virtue of living in the tri-state area, I have been able to see a decent amount of Giants games. I see that you conveniently left out the Jets from that question. But look, I think the Giants are on the right path. They've got a really solid group of young guys who made the team exciting to watch last year, made them quite competitive in many games. And while I think a few of them suffered some fairly devastating injuries, the hope is that they can bounce back fully healthy this year. But otherwise, I think things are going in the right direction. They hired a great new coach in John Harbaugh. I think here with the upcoming draft, prioritizing defense is going to be the most fruitful for the year ahead.
So what defensive player do you think that would still be available at 5 would have the biggest impact?
I'd have to Google this really quick to answer that appropriately.
But do you think we can leave it at defense? And for the sake of not showing any bias as a journalist, what would you do if you're the Jets? I should have asked you about that too. You're right.
For the Jets, I think at the end of the day, to be successful in the NFL, you really need a quarterback. Teams live and die by the quarterback position. And it's just really tough to achieve success, no matter how great the rest of the team is. And so, unless they're able to score a stud quarterback here that can immediately produce, I fear that there's just going to be more pain on the horizon for Jets fans. Sorry, guys.
Sorry to hear that for all my Jets fan listeners. And as a Giants fan, I'm hopeful that you're right and that Jackson Dart can turn the franchise around. Mike, this has been a lot of fun, and thank you again for coming on the podcast.
I agree. This has been fun. Really appreciate you hosting and allowing me to participate.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning into Crossroads. If you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast player, and please give us a 5-star rating so others can find our podcast. Until next time, this has been Crossroads.